feedback.
Thank you. I'd love to thank the organizer for giving a chance to give a talk, which was asked 2 days ago. So I'm talking about this stuff, you know, the star formation in the early universe, but at exactly zero metallicity. So which is not the main topic in this meeting, but perhaps the final goal is to see the signature of such transition to, you know, star formation at zero metallicity. So this, I believe this is included in the meeting.
Actually, before the first star, the temperature of the universe was like 0.3 Kelvin, the coldest it ever gets.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for...
The coldest period is actually just before this thing started.
All right. Thank you for your support. So, so I'm talking about the population of three stars. But the primary question the people are asking in these, you know, 10 years is mass. You know, how massive our population three stars were. So maybe you have heard about the population three stars are probably massive, but the problem is how massive. So that is a question. So the star formation process, you know, goes over two different phases. So the first phase is the early collapse stage. So in this stage, there is no star. So, you know, the gas cloud is just dynamic collapses. And so this, you know, the Naoki simulation shows the final snapshot for this early collapse stage. At this final moment, so there's a protostar. So this is, you know, the stellar size. But at this moment, the stellar mass is very tiny, you know, 10 to minus 2 solar mass star. And this tiny protostar is surrounded by a huge gas cloud. And gas, you know, the mass of gas cloud is 1,000 solar mass. And what happens next? What happens next is this accretion stage. So in this stage, the protostar gets a mass from the, you know, surrounding envelope. The gas remained in this envelope begins to accrete on the protostar. And the key parameter in this stage is the accretion rate onto the protostar. The accretion rate is just, you know, written by this equation. The genes mass divided by freehold time. And this only depends on the temperature. But with the typical temperature of primordial gas, the mass accretion rate is quite huge, 10 to minus 3 solar mass per year. And we have a time of a stellar lifetime, so which is around mega year for massive stars. And with this mega year and this mass accretion rate, we may be possible to get the 1,000 solar mass star finally. But this just depends on the assumption that the stellar mass accretion should continue for this time scale. But in any rate, the final stellar mass is fixed when the mass accretion ends. So we have to study what happens in this stage to determine the final stellar mass. And another relevant topic is first supermassive black hole. So recent observation shows a number like 10 very bright quasars are found, detected beyond the redshift of 6. And the mass is very huge, like 10 to 9 solar mass or exceeding 10 to 10 solar mass at redshift 6. So this is actually a problem because there's no time. The age of the universe of redshift 7 is less than 1 giga year. So we have to get these massive guys within this time scale. So let's think about beginning with this population 3 remnant black hole, which is probably around 100 solar mass. So how is this difficult? So and let's assume the mass accretion continues. Mass accretion at the Eddington rate should continue for this cosmic time. So this is a time scale to get this 10 to 9 solar mass black hole with this Eddington accretion. So it should take 0.8 giga year. So this is close to this cosmic age at redshift 7. So it might be possible, but of course, in order to get this time scale, we need this 100% of the duty cycle, so which is not available in the present day universe, because normally the feedback can control or feedback can reduce this duty cycle. So this might be a problem. So what is the key questions? Key questions I address is like this. So what is the final mass of the first star? So we are, you know, thinking about the exact value of mass of the first star. And as I said, to determine the final mass of first stars, we have to study what happens in this late accretion stage. So because in this accretion stage, the stellar mass largely increases by mass accretion. And another question is, what is the maximal mass of the first star? And is it possible to see a supermassive black hole in the early universe? So in any rate, as I said, so we have to study the late evolution in the accretion stage to answer this question. But actually, there are two potential barriers to get very massive stars in the early universe. So one is actually the feedback effect. The other is might be a fragmentation, disk fragmentation. So I'm talking about these problems. So the one, number one is the UV feedback effect. And okay, so in this case, there is no metals, there is no dust grains, but there is some potential feedback mechanism such which can potentially suppress the mass accretion onto the protostar. So that is the formation of H region, so-called UV feedback effect. So that was, this is originally proposed by Chris McKee and Jonathan. And so this this panel shows my previous simulation, 2D simulation. So this is the radiation hydro simulation. And this panel shows the time sequence, you know, of the evolution after the formation of the tiny protostar. So maybe you can see the bipolar H2 region is now forming and, you know, try to suppress the mass accretion onto the protostar. And this figure shows the evolution of accretion rate on the protostar. So this blue line shows evolution for this case. And this red curve shows the evolution without feedback effect. In this case, the initial condition is almost the same, exactly the same, but I only turned off the feedback effect. So this difference shows the strength, the effect of the this relative feedback effect. So as you can see, the feedback effect is very strong. And finally, the mass accretion to the protostar is stopped by the feedback effect. In this case, in this one particular case, the final mass is only around, you know, 40 solar mass. So this might be a problem to get a very massive star in the early universe. The mass accretion to the protostar might be stopped or halted by the this feedback effect. So how possible to form very massive stars again against this feedback mechanism? So this is one question, key question. But of course, this is only one case. So we are also working on some statistical work. So in this case, we perform this kind of large, you know, large cosmological simulation, structure formation simulation, and you know, we identify the location of star formation in the large box of cosmological simulation, and we pick up the, you know, star forming cloud from this simulation box, and then we follow the subsequent evolution until the protostar, you know, protostellar feedback finally shuts off the mass accretion. And we finally perform this kind of simulation, a series of this kind of simulation for more than 100 cases. And by repeating this simulation by more than 100 times, so we can get the mass distribution of, you know, population of three stars. So this is one example. This is finally, the mass spectrum based on more than 100 cases, more than 1,000 cases of, you know, star forming cloud detected in the cosmological simulation. So this is the stellar mass, and this is the number. The total number is now more than 1,000, as I said. So here is 100 solar mass, and this is 10 and 1,000. So you can see there are ordinary massive stars, like, you know, a few or several times 10 solar mass. But there is another, you know, populations that might be okay. The, you know, very massive stars, like a few times 100 solar mass, but still less than 1,000. So this might be a problem. As I said, the starting with a possibly remnant black hole of, you know, 100 solar mass, that might be difficult to get a 10 to 9 solar mass black hole within the cosmic age until redshift 6 or 7. And another potential barrier to get very massive star in the early universe might be a disk fragmentation. So this is, you know, this effect is has been discovered by this kind of 3D simulation, like in the present day star formation simulations. So the mechanism is simple. You know, as I said, the mass, you know, the gas in the envelope begins to accrete with some finite angular momentum, and then the, you know, the circumstellar disk is gradually growing around the protostar. But such accretion disk can be gravitationally unstable, and sometimes, you know, this kind of fragmentation occurs. Yeah, so this kind of disk fragmentation can be caused by this gravitational instability. And in this case, the a cluster of lower mass stars might be formed instead of a single or a small number of massive stars. So in this case, finally, the, you know, the mass of the final stellar mass might be deduced by this fragmentation effect. So it's obvious to go to, you know, it's obvious we have to go to the 3D simulation to check this effect. So we are now going to the 3D simulation, 3D radiation hydro simulation. So this is one example of my simulation, my recent work. But in my simulation, the fragmentation do occur as expected, but I don't think the fragmentation does not necessarily prevent the massive star formation because the mass, you know, fragment is always migrating inward because of the gravitational torque, like this. So this panel shows the evolution for only 100 solar mass, 100 years, and you can see the fragments are, you know, emerging in the circumstellar disk. But these fragments rapidly migrate inward. So this is because the gravitational torque, you know, the fragment is appearing within the arm, the spiral arm, and this spiral arm can cause the gravitational torque, which bring the fragments to inward. So this is actually very rapid, and this is a well-known process as a type 1 migration in the context of planet formation. So I believe the fragmentation does not always prevent the very massive star formation in the early universe. But what happens for this case? So that is another problem. In this case, each fragment rapidly you know, migrate inward and finally accrete onto the central star. And as a result, the accretion rate is very time dependent, very chaotic. And sometimes accretion burst is caused when this fragment, you know, approach to the central star. So the kind of episodic accretion is caused by this case. And in this case, so very rapid mass accretion is realized for some short durations. And actually, this very rapid mass accretion might be a key, because this rapid accretion can change the stellar structure, which I explained. So this is my another work of the stellar evolution. So in this case, I solve the interior structure of the star numerically under the constant mass accretion rate. So this is a stellar mass, and this is a stellar radius. And the different line shows a different accretion rate. In this case, for this case, I assume the constant mass accretion rate. This is just a given parameters. So this is a normal. This black curve shows a normal case. So in this case, at some point, protostar begins to contract, and the hydrogen burning starts at this point. So after this point, this is a main sequence, zero age main sequence stage, and before this point, so this is so-called a pre-main sequence stage. So this is a standard evolution, but this evolution can be changed with very rapid mass accretion. For example, this Mazenda curve, so this is for the accretion rate of 0.006 solar mass per year. So in this case, protostar never contracts. The stellar radius always, you know, continues to increase like this. And this is the intermediate case, 0.03 solar mass per year, 0.006 solar mass per year. So the So this is the issue. So the very rapid mass accretion can change the protostar evolution. And as I said, the protostar never contracts to reach this main sequence point, but largely, you know, continues to largely expand with very rapid mass accretion. And with very large radius, the stellar effective temperature is reduced, right? For massive stars, the total luminosity is always close to the Eddington value. But with a large radius, the effective temperature is, you know, very reduced, largely reduced. And as I said, now the primary feedback effect is the UV feedback. But in this case, the stellar effective temperature becomes like, you know, a few times 1,000 Kelvin. So the total stellar UV luminosity is very reduced, you know, largely reduced. So the, you know, the UV feedback effect becomes very weak. So that might be a way to get, you know, circumvent the UV feedback effect. So maybe you cannot believe this kind of, you know, simulation. Theoretically, it might be okay, but this is always theoretically, but actually there is a physics, you know, with which I can explain this behavior. So this is very simple. This is a, okay, so let's begin this equation. This is a normal, you know, definition of the stellar luminosity, this like this. And as I said, for massive stars, the stellar luminosity is always close to the Eddington value, which is proportional to the stellar mass. And now the main opacity mechanism near the stellar surface is H minus opacity, which has a very strong time, you know, temperature dependence. And thanks to this strong temperature dependence, actually the effective temperature is almost locked at you know, some particular value like 5,000 Kelvin. So this is an analogy of a so-called highest track in the pre-main sequence stage. So maybe you can, maybe you should have run this in the class. And in the HR diagram, this highest track is very, you know, almost perpendicular in the HR diagram, which means that effective temperature is always almost constant, right? So this is because of the strong temperature dependence of H minus opacity. So the same mechanism should work for this case because, you know, now the protostar is very bloated and the effective temperature is very low and the, you know, main opacity source is H minus opacity. So now let's get back to this equation. The effective temperature is constant, and the stellar luminosity is proportional to mass. And then the stellar radius should be proportional to this stellar mass to 0.5. And this analytic line is this green curve in this figure. Okay, I didn't explain this lower panel, so, but this is the same plot, but for the larger, higher accretion rate. So as you can see, this analytical you know, relationship well explains the behavior of this numerical work. So the protostar begins to largely expand with very rapid mass accretion. And such signature can be found in the numerical simulation. Okay, so this is a numerical, you know, 3D radiation hydro simulation to follow the accretion process to the normal, you know, population three stars. And this background shows the temperature distribution, and this, you know, arrow shows the velocity distributions. And you can see the feedback effect in this movie. So this is actually a movie. And you can see the H region is forming, but there is some effect. Okay, so you can see the H region is forming like this, but you know, the formation and extinction of H region is repeated. So this is caused by the, you know, rapid expansion of the protostar, because at some moment the accretion rate onto the protostar is enhanced because of the episodic accretion. So the, you know, Kelvin, you know, contraction of protostar is always, you know, disturbed by such you know, episodic accretion. So as a result, it's difficult to keep the expansion of the H2 region always disturbed, and in this case the feedback effect is only works intermittently and very inefficient to stop the mass accretion. So when this kind of evolution happens, finally the very massive star forms, you know, by circumventing the feedback UV feedback effect, like, you know, 200 or 300 solar masses. But this is a normal case, you know, normal population three-star formation case. But let's move on to the next topic. So this is, you know, another mode of massive star formation in the early universe. So recently, people are, you know, people are thinking about more extreme case, which is a direct collapse, and which is the formation of supermassive stars, like 10 to 5 solar mass. So as I said, the typical stellar mass of typical stellar mass for population three, normal population three stars are like 100 solar mass. But so this is obviously the special case of population three star formation without, you know, heavy elements. I mean. So in this case, so this is actually the second generation of primordial star formation. So let's think about some UV radiation field created by nearby galaxy or nearby light sources. In this case, hydrogen molecules can be destroyed by such far-UV effect, far-UV radiation. And because of this destruction of coolant, you know, the hydrogen molecule, the thermal evolution can be modified like this. So this is a low T diagram. So this is the density. So this is the kind of time, and this is a temperature. So this lower curve shows the normal case with the hydrogen molecule cooling. So in this case, the coolant is a hydrogen molecule. But let's think about the case where the hydrogen molecules are destroyed by nearby light source. In this case, the thermal evolution can be changed like this. So this curve. This curve shows the evolution with very strong far UV radiation field. So in this case, only coolant is you know, atomic hydrogen. Atomic hydrogen, with atomic hydrogen, the temperature is always close to 8,000 Kelvin. So the temperature is much enhanced, you know, very enhanced in this for this case. With each atomic cooling, the collapse advances almost isothermally at the temperature of 8,000 Kelvin. And this high temperature is actually very nice to get a very massive star because, as I said, the accretion rate should be proportional to this temperature, T to 1.5. So with higher temperature, we can get a higher accretion rate. And always, so we only have a time scale of mega year, so which is you know, still a lifetime. And with this high accretion rate, like 0.1 solar mass per year, we can get the very high, you know, very massive stellar mass within the stellar lifetime. So finally, we might be able to get this 10 to 5 solar mass star, and this 10 to 5 solar mass star may become the gravitational very unstable because of the GR effect, and finally, 10 to 5 solar mass black hole might form directly. But the questions we are addressing is, you know, this. So is this really possible? So this shows the, you know, the rapid mass accretion may allow the formation of you know, this kind of very massive star. But as I showed in the previous slide, the stellar feedback or some disk fragmentation might be the issue. Okay, so UV feedback and disk fragmentation can prevent the stellar mass growth. So is it true or not? So this is the motivation. So we performed the hydro simulations, both for normal population three-star case and direct collapse case. So this is direct collapse case is this case with you know, atomic cooling case. So this again, this is a low T plane. This is a number density and temperature. So from now we are doing the 2D, you know, phase on this kind of you know, hydro simulation. But in this case, so we adopted you know, barotropic equation of state, you know, the temperature as a function of density. So we fixed the equation of state. We just took this you know, curves of the one zone calculation. So this blue curve shows the evolution for the normal POP3 case, where H2 molecule can operate as a coolant. And red curve, this red curve shows the evolution for direct collapse case, where hydrogen atomic hydrogen is a coolant. And temperature, as you can see, the temperature is much higher for this case. So let's do the simulation. So this is one snapshot of the simulation, and this is for the direct collapse case. For both cases, we can observe the disk fragmentation because there is a very rapid mass accretion onto the disk from the envelope, and always the disk can become gravitationally unstable, and so we can get fragments around the protostar as a result of disk fragmentation. But the strength of the fragmentation actually is different among the direct Krups case and normal POP3 case. I explain why. But before that, let's see the number of fragments. So this panel shows the number of fragments. So this is the number of fragments. This is the time scale after the epoch of the embryo protostar. So this is for the normal POP3 case. And this histogram shows so how many fragments are observed for each snapshot. So normally, so you can see around 10 fragments are moving around in the disk for the normal POP3 case. But for direct Krups case, so here is the number of 100. So in this case, the disk is more fragment and more the number of fragments is much larger than this case. So as I said, the direct Krups case shows a more unstable disk with greater number of fragments, as this figure shows. But don't worry, because the most of the fragments rapidly migrate inward because of the gravitational torque, like a type 1 migration. So then it's possible to feed the central star always. But sometimes gravitational ejection occurs, but that is a minor effect. Most of the fragments can rapidly migrate inward towards the central star. So the stellar growth by this episodic mass accretion is always possible. And then I can explain why there's a difference. So this is because of the difference of accretion states, of course. And okay, so now we are thinking about the stability of accreting disk. But actually, in this case, the disk stability is determined by the balance between these accretion rates. One is the mass transfer rate through the accretion disk. So because of the non-asymmetric structure, which is excited by the self-gravity, so it's possible to transport the mass and angular momentum through the disk. And then the mass transfer rate should be determined by such non-asymmetric structure. And another rate is the mass supply rate from the envelope to the disk. So because there is always the mass inflow from the envelope to the disk. And if this inflow rate is larger than this mass transfer rate through the disk, the mass is always accumulating within the disk, and then the this tumor Q parameter is getting lower, and finally you will get the gravitational fragmentation of the disk. So this balance is very important. This balance is actually determined by the disk temperature balance, the disk temperature and the embryo temperature, and this tumor Q parameter is actually written as this equation. So as I said, the temperature balance is important, and in this figure, actually the density range for the envelope is like this here, and above this value, so this is the disk range. And as this figure shows, the temperature balance is different for the direct Krups case and normal POP3 case. For normal POP3 case, so the temperature is always increasing like this. So this is because of the balance, because of the balance between the compressional heating and this hydrogen molecular cooling. But as a result, the temperature is gradually increasing, as you see. But for this direct Krups case, the temperature is almost isothermal, but gradually decreases, as you see. So then this balance is different. So for direct Krups case, there is a negative slope of low T plane like this, and then so it's easy to get a smaller value of tumor Q parameter, and then so you can make accretion disk more stable. So this is the reason why the disk is more gravitation unstable for a DC case. So this curve, to draw this curve, that effect is included. at some point, the cooling mechanism is switched to different, like a two-photon emission. Yeah, that's included. And this slight decrease is a result of this that switch. If you assume the optically thin Lyman alpha cooling always, so then the I expect the temperature is always around 8,000 Kelvin. So but finally, so we checked the stellar evolution with this very rapid, very time dependent mass accretion. So this is a time, and this is a accretion rate in the previous. Okay, so this kind of simulation. And this figure shows that accretion rate is very time dependent, very chaotic. And okay, so let's ignore this green and red curve. So this blue curve is the original accretion history. And so as I said, in this case, the disk is very unstable, and the much more variable accretion than in the normal POP3 case is observed. The problem is, how is the stellar evolution, how is the evolution like with this very rapid and very time-dependent accretion history? So we performed the stellar evolution calculation as a post-process, and this shows the result. So this is the time, and this is the evolution of the mass and the radius. So this is the mass, and this is the radius. So as you can see, the stellar radius is always increasing, and the stellar radius is always very large, like this. So this is because of very rapid mass accretion, as I said. Under this rapid mass accretion, the protostar gets inflated, and the protostar can enter the supergiant stage. So that's why the stellar radius is very large. And with this very large stellar radius, the expected UV feedback is very weak. So that might be possible to get a very massive star by circumventing the UV feedback effect. Yes, I'm reached the final slide. So let me summarize. So I'm now getting back to the original questions, key questions. The first one is what is the final mass of the protostars? So according to our statistical studies, so there's a diversity. And there are ordinary massive stars, like a few or several times 10 solar mass stars. But on the other hand, there are a number of very massive stars exceeding 100 solar mass stars. But for this case, the stellar mass is limited by the mass of original cloud, which is around 1,000 solar mass. So this, in this normal mode of star formation, it's difficult to get very, very massive star exceeding 1,000 solar mass. But there's another idea to get another mode of very high mass star formation in the early universe. So that is a direct collapse case. And so the next question is what is the maximum mass of the first star? So this is highly uncertain, but some layer of favorable conditions may allow the formation of this extremely massive star, like exceeding 1,000 solar mass, or 10,000, or even 100,000 may be possible. But to get such extremely massive star, we have to circumvent the UV feedback and disk fragmentation effect. But I believe it might be possible with some limited condition. That is my impression. So I stop here. Thank you.
Okay, Fred. I don't know if this is a comment or a question, but there's another interesting piece of physics that's on the table that you didn't talk about. Mm-hmm. If you have a star that's bigger than about 100 solar masses, mm-hmm. then the radiation pressure in the interior dominates the ideal gas law pressure. Oh. And you can show that if you're in the limit that it's all radiation pressure, you have a pure N equals 3 polytrope. And mm-hmm. you can show simply, analytically, that if you have an N equals 3 polytrope, it's doesn't have a preferred radius. And that means that the star at any radius has the same total thermal and gravitational energy.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why your stars don't contract, is because they're not energetically favorable. It's not energetically favorable for them to contract, right?
For such case, that's a polytrope with a index of for that. But for such case, the stellar radius is determined by the surface structure. And right. So in this case, the star is not just a polytrope. We are solving the interior structure, resolving the detailed structure near the stellar surface, and that determines the stellar radius.
Oh, right, but mm-hmm. most of the star is dominated by the interior,
radiation
right?
Radiation pressure, and, yeah,
and,
that's true.
And that makes
that's
it true. A it makes it sort of a different sort of beast than what you think of when you think of a star.
They have radiation pressure, though.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
But no, but that's just a physical explanation for why it doesn't contract. Because it's not energetically capable.
Hmm. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I have a question. In your simulation, you do not consider a magnetic field.
No.
But if you have even a minimum magnetic field, it can totally disrupt your picture because the magnetic field practically prevent the disk to form, and then you don't form anymore.
That should depend on the strength of the magnetic field. And I know some people are working on the amplification of the magnetic field during the crafts by the dynamo effect, but always controversial. But currently the strength of the magnetic field is not too strong. I mean, not so strong to modify the dynamics.
You don't have any idea what is the magnetic field in this moment in the universe.
No. But I believe it is possible to think about the very small, very tiny magnetic field created by some cosmological effect. But with such seed value, so it is still difficult to amplify enough to modify the dynamics.
Yeah. Now, when we have this red supergiant star, but at a certain moment, it has to relax to become an OB star.
Yes, some moment.
And then the OB star would be at zero metallicity conditions, as far as I know, more compact
And
hotter.
Right.
So that's actually an additional effect.
Yes, finally. But my point is, if you have accretion, rapid accretion ongoing, you can keep the star bloated.
That's true.
But at some point, I believe the mass accretion is is finishing. Yeah. So before, after that point, the protostar starts to contract. And at some point, the UV feedback begins to operate.
And how long does this contraction take? Is that the third?
That depends on the stellar mass. And KH time is longer with the higher stellar mass. So with I don't think so. That longer for the higher stellar mass.
It might be the same, L over m. The luminosity is proportional to mass.
No. Yes, but the gravitational energy, energy is squared. Right.
KH time generally becomes short.
No, longer.
I mean, it's just for a radiation pressure dominated star, right? In the limit of completely radiation pressure dominated, your gravitational binding energy is zero, so your KH time is zero. Real stars, in the modern universe don't ever get to that, but in these, super giant, super puffy stars, they do.
No.
Or am I getting that wrong? It's their gravitational binding energy, right? So.
Yeah, but the point is the bloating layer has only small fraction of the stellar mass. So most of the star is near the center. So there is no homogeneous density distribution within the star.
Okay, I see.
And I had a second comment or question. Now we're talking about zero H main sequence, but there is also deuterium burning.
Yes.
So how does this?
No, I don't believe the deuterium binding is important for this case because you know, the main source of stellar luminosity is the release of gravitational energy. And for the supergiant cases, we included all of the, you know, nuclear reactions, but the luminosity created by the nuclear fusion is always lower than the total luminosity. So it's a minor component.
Okay, so no fluctuations due to change.
No.
Okay. I'd like to ask a question about your work on the fragmentation of the disk around the supermassive star, where you have hundreds of fragments.
Right.
How sure are you that you can follow? I mean, there must be a regime where you have a lot, you know, very strong fragmentation, and you essentially form a disk of stars which don't accrete. I mean,
don't accrete means.
So it sounds like your disk around the supermassive star is getting closer to that regime than your disk around the normal POP3 star. So what's your treatment of the fragments? I mean, you're stiffening the equation of state, I assume, or how sure are you they're not really going to collapse to form stars which will decouple from the disk?
In the current simulation, the equation of state is barotropic, and I think the collapse of each fragment might be slow, might be decelerated by the, you know, resolution effect. But as simulation shows, the migration to the central star is very rapid, and I expect the stellar growth, I mean the growth of each fragment, it takes some time, and that should be longer than the migration time scale, I believe.
So you're not worried about this, the physics of your that's included. You can think you can follow them. Right?
I don't know, but on the other hand, there is some ejection, some small number of protostar or some fragments can be ejected. But that might be a problem.
Any further questions? Well, actually, let me ask one beforehand. So. One of the new results you're showing here is that in your disks around normal population three stars, you have some fragmentation, but you're saying all the fragments migrate in.
Right.
And I think that's different from the conclusions from, I think, the Heidelberg group. I know Simon Glover's here. So I'm just curious if there's some agreement there, or there's perhaps Simon also can comment a little bit on Takashi's results. Because you understand there's some difference of opinion.
I think so.
There's a difference to how we're treating the fragments. I mean, we use sync particles, so we're assuming they're all collapsing and decoupling, and you're not. So.
Yeah, but I think, you know, their latest results, you know, includes the stellar merger or merger between the sync particles, and you know, in their simulation, the spatial resolution is much higher than mine, and you know, they can get you know, a number of fragments, like 100 of a fragment, but 2/3 of such fragments finally merge.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in Thomas Greif's work from a few years ago, we certainly saw that some fragments scattered out and other ones merged. I don't think we disagree about that a lot of these things are going to
fall. So most of the fragments are migrating inwards, so there's agreement.
So the question is just how many do survive? Is it zero or is it non-zero?
Right.
Okay, last question then, Hans.
Sorry for taking so many questions. I'm still awake.
okay.
Nobody commented on the supermassive black hole part of your talk. That's why I wanted to throw in that question. I mean, the seed mass. So how critical are these seed masses, you know? I mean, if you change, does it have to be fine-tuned to get to these supermassive black holes? Are there other ways to get to supermassive black holes early on, other than merging of these very big stars?
Uh, 400 solar masses?
Yeah, but then for such case, the problem is, you know, keeping 100% of duty cycle.
So is that realistic, or do we sort of go
maybe
on a limb now?
Yeah, you know, a number of cosmological simulations has been done to check if that is possible or not. But the answer is almost impossible.
You're saying it's very difficult to get those conditions?
Huh? No, I mean the keeping the 100% of duty cycle. It's
those things are 5 or 6 sigma fluctuations.
Right.
No.
Okay. So those objects, this high-redshift quasars are extraordinarily rare, right? This lone quasar is like 1 per cubic gigaparsec. So there's four, five, six sigma fluctuations. So they live in extremely non-standard environments. First of all, everything actually accretes on them. So they probably accrete on much higher than Eddington luminosity because basically the whole universe around them falling onto them because they're such high density peaks. Mm-hmm. And maybe someone did it, but I'm just not aware. I don't think I'm not aware of anyone actually modeling this as six sigma fluctuations. That will be actually very non-trivial numerical exercise because you need to have very highly constrained initial conditions. So I don't know about any cosmological simulation that actually models.
But what I was concerned was the stellar dynamical aspect, because you have lots of stars, they form binaries, they scatter, they eject
it's
other
true,
stars.
But these are the problems that you have if you start from a stellar mass black hole, like 10 or 100 solar masses, particularly because they live most of the time in the middle of nowhere, so they don't accrete. So, because they fly away very at high velocity. So that solution, the solution that Takashi is suggesting, which I think I agree, it's one possible way to solve the problem, is that you start from a seed which is already 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, right away. So then you can allow yourself also times at which you're not accreting, even though the accretion rate for this object that are sitting very likely at the center of their halos and don't move that fast is much easier than for low stellar mass black holes.
To be fair enough and represent even other voices of the community, there are simulations where they attempt to follow the dynamics of more ordinary mass black holes, like tens of solar masses, and they do find that there are environments in which they have brief phases of super Eddington accretion, and these can somehow help they are brief and they can make it. I mean, they can get to the 10 to the 5 solar mass black holes that you form as a direct collapse in a relatively decent amount of time.
If I understood it correctly, right, you need atomic cooling. So you need this to be a second halo.
Right.
And that cannot happen because it's also high density peaks, so they will collapse first. So they will never get anyone else to shine on them and to suppress their accretion.
Yeah, but
I think you're right. I think there are still some difficulties in this direct collapse scenario. And understanding is that they're very
the number of direct collapse candidate halo required to explain the very distant supermassive black hole is very small. So the possibility should be very small. So that is okay.
So then most supermassive black holes form by a different mechanism?
I don't know, but
They're extremely biased.
Yes.
They're the only ones in the lot.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no one else there to suppress.
And so you're going to use your POP3 seeds for the rest of them?
Several satellites, we could be mini halo. Sorry?
That one would look out
Not necessarily.
We're going to continue over the drinks later.
It's over.
Okay, let's thank Takashi again. Our last talk of the day is from Masami Uchi, and he's going to tell us about evolution of high redshift star-forming galaxies.